Thanks very much, Kushla. So as was just said, the FX Global Code of Conduct was launched just over a couple of weeks ago in London. You can find it on the newly constituted Global Foreign Exchange Committee's website, which is www.globalfxc.org. And this is what it looks like, though it's probably most easily accessible in electronic form. There's all sorts of nice tabs and other features around in it. But I would recommend, if you haven't already looked for it, it's very easily found on that. It's also found via the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee's website. Anyway, it's easy to find, and if you haven't already read it or sought it out, I would please implore you to do so. So what I'd like to do today is reiterate the motivation for why we did this work over the last couple of years, highlight some of the main features of the code and the associated adherence framework, summarise how we got to where we got to, and then talk a bit about the way forward. So firstly, let me talk about why this work has been necessary, which I think should be reasonably obvious to most people in this room, which is the FX industry has been suffering for a number of years from a lack of trust. And this lack of trust is evident between participants in the market and, at least as importantly, between the public and the market. And so the market needs to move towards a more favourable and desirable location and allow participants to have much greater confidence that the market is functioning appropriately. So to that end, the code sets out good global principles of good practice in the FX market to provide a common set of guidance to the market. And we think in doing so, this will help to restore confidence and promote the effective functioning of the wholesale FX market. And a well-functioning FX market is very much in the interest of all market participants. And that clearly includes us as central banks, both in our own role as market participants, but also because the exchange rate is an important channel of monetary policy transmission. So in a globalised world, the FX market is one of the most vital parts of the financial plumbing. One of the guiding principles that has underpinned our work in developing the code is that the code should promote a robust, fair, liquid, open and transparent market. A diverse set of buyers and sellers, supported by resilient infrastructure, should be able to confidently and effectively transact at competitive prices that reflect available market information and in a manner that conforms to acceptable standards of behaviour. So note that I'm talking about all sections of the FX market, sellers and buyers and infrastructure. So the work to develop the code began 2 years ago in May 2015 when the BIS governors commissioned a working group of the Markets Committee of the BIS, which I chaired up until beginning of this year, to do two things. The first was establish a single global code of conduct for the wholesale FX market, and then secondly, to come up with mechanisms to promote greater adherence to the code, i.e. to get people to follow it. So this work was very much a public sector, private sector partnership. We were ably and vigorously supported by a group of market participants, chaired by David Puth, who most of you know, I'm sure, CEO of CLS. And David's group contained people from all around the world on the buy side, including corporates and asset managers, and the sell side, along with trading platforms, ECNs, and non-bank participants, drawing from the various foreign exchange committees around the world. And Hugh Killen, who we'll be hearing from shortly, was the person from this part of the world on that group and also devoted a hell of a lot of time and energy to the whole process, along with Matt Bogue from the Reserve Bank. All parts of the market were involved in the drafting of the code. So this was not drafted by any one part of the market. It was drafted by all participants in the market, both on the private and the public sector side, to make sure all perspectives were heard and appropriately reflected. And there are two important points worth highlighting. First of all, it's a single code for the whole industry. And secondly, it's a global code. So on the first point, the code supplants the existing codes that have been present in the FX market. And in line of one of the major sponsors of the evening tonight, the ACI have adopted the global FX code as the relevant part of the ACI code in covering the FX industry, which I think was fantastic to see, which also means that from the Australian point of view, the transition is fairly easy in the sense that the ACI code, as you all know, was the code which we used here, and now it's the FX global code, but the ACI FX code and the global FX code are one and the same. So it is very much the code which is relevant for this part of the world, but it's also relevant for the markets in all parts of the world. And to that end, the code covers all of the wholesale FX industry. This is not a code for just the sell side. It is there for the sell side, the buy side, non-bank participants and the platforms. It reaches around the globe and across the whole industry. The way it is relevant to you will depend on the nature of your engagement with the FX market. So what that means in practice is that the steps different market participants take to align their activities with the principles of the code will differ, reflecting the size and complexity and type and extent of their engagement with the FX market. If I'm a corporate who has only reasonably infrequent engagement with the market, it's probably most useful for you as a sort of how-to guide for the FX market, what the standards of behaviour you should be expecting from your counterparty. If I'm a large sell-side bank, then pretty much the whole code is relevant for all your activities in the market. The other point worth emphasising is it's a global code. So our group contain representatives from the central banks and private sectors from all of the largest 16 FX centres in the world, from 1 down through 16, be they developed or emerging markets. So we have the Chinese involved, we have the Koreans involved, the Mexicans, the Brazilians, the Indians, in terms of the developing world, as well as all of the large developed FX markets. The first phase of the code was released in May 2016, and it covered areas such as ethics, information sharing, some aspects of execution, as well as confirmation and settlement. The second phase, or the whole thing, which is now out, covered further aspects of execution, including e-trading and platforms, prime brokerage, as well as governance and risk management and compliance. So the complete code, which is this thing, comprises 55 principles spanning these issues. The principles are written in plain language. So when I'm speaking elsewhere in the world, I say it's written in plain Australian, but that probably doesn't go quite so well here. But anyway, works well in London, that line. And should be easily read and understood by market participants. It is written in simple to understand Australian. The principles are supplemented by a suite of examples to illustrate their practical application. So the code contains those 55 principles, and then alongside them, or sitting at the back actually, is a bunch of examples which illustrate exactly what we mean by those principles. And there are examples of both good and bad behaviour there. So we illustrate them both on the positive and the negative. Market participants have had a number of opportunities to comment on the code in addition to the direct input we receive from the market participants group. Before its release, drafts of the full text of the code were distributed to market participants for their review through the various foreign exchange committees, but also through other industry associations to ensure all perspectives were appropriately reflected in the code. So through this process, we received and processed more than 10,000 comments, and they were all actually taken on board, thought about, and a response was given to them. The code reflects our collective judgment as to what constitutes good practice in the market, taking account of the feedback that we received. I think it's a good outcome of the process that we're able to distill the points of contention down to a very small number of issues. So outside of that, the feedback reflected a widely held consensus as to what is good practice. The degree of consensus and the willingness to contribute to the process reflects the fact that market participants have recognised the code's aim of helping move the FX market to a better place. So one of our central aims in drafting the code is for it to be principles-based rather than rules-based. There are a number of reasons why this is so, but for me, an important reason is that the more prescriptive the code is, the easier it is to get around. Rules are much easier to arbitrage than principles, if you want to put it in market vernacular. The more prescriptive and the more precise the code, the less people actually think about what they are doing. If it's principles-based and less prescriptive, the market participants will have to think about whether their actions are consistent with the principles of the code. But we have not written a procedures manual. Amongst other things, a procedures manual is generally a bit fatter than that. Rather, we have articulated principles that need to be taken into account. Individual firms may then take these principles and reflect them in their own procedures manuals. So our aim in setting out these principles is to provide market participants with a framework in which to think about how they, for example, handle their stop-loss orders. And the emphasis here is very much on the word think. Let me talk a bit now about the adherence side of things. Alongside drafting the code, we've devoted considerable time and effort to thinking about how to ensure widespread adoption of the code by market participants. So clearly that has been an issue with the various existing codes that have been in place in a number of markets. It is evident that they were ignored on occasion in the past, willfully or otherwise. So we have worked with the industry to produce a principles-based code rather than a set of prescriptive regulatory standards. The code is not regulation. I am not a regulator, nor would any of the other central bank participants on the group. The code does not impose legal or regulatory obligations on market participants, nor will it supplant existing regulatory standards or expectations. So to that end, we have developed a blueprint for adherence that has been published alongside the code, and you can find it on the Global FXC website, and which sets out the key elements we think will be required for the code to be successful and the steps that have been taken and will be taken to ensure this is the case. So one critical dimension, given it's a voluntary code, is market-based adherence mechanisms. An important element of discipline should come from the market itself. The adherence to a voluntary code will only come about if firms judge it to be in their interests and take the practical steps to ensure the code is embedded in their practices. Such practical steps would include training their staff and putting in appropriate procedures and policies. One of the main mechanisms we have provided is a draft statement of commitment for firms to publicly demonstrate their adherence to the code. So one reason for public demonstration is that the firms are more likely to adhere to the code if they believe that their peers are doing so too. So if you were to have read today's profit and loss update, you would have seen Colin talk at length about, about the value of peer pressure in ensuring adherence. And so that is very much an important part of the adherence mechanism. An important source of pressure to adhere should come from other market participants. To provide visibility around this, there are a number of market-based initiatives which are close to fruition to provide public registries where you as a market participant can go and see that the firms have actually put out their statements of commitment. We should have some more information out, these registries should be out in the public domain in the near future, in the next 4 to 6 weeks, I hope. So that will provide a place where you as a market participant can both post your own statement of commitment, but then also see who else has done so. More broadly, you as a market participant, but you as anyone else actually in the market, will be able to access that information. More broadly, market participants have a vital interest and a role to play in promoting and upholding good practices in the market as a whole. This can be partly achieved through leading by example, but can also be supported by having similar expectations of your own counterparties and other market participants, and helping to raise awareness of the code in your market interactions. So in that regard, over the last 6 months or so, we have reached out to more than 120 industry associations and key market infrastructure providers globally. In Australia, that includes AFMA, who has put out a statement of support of the code, as well as the NZFMA, who I know are not technically in Australia, but at least they are members of the part of the Australian Foreign Exchange community. Ultimately, the success of the code in promoting integrity and restoring confidence in the wholesale FX market lies in the hands of its participants. Another aspect of market-based adherence comes through the FXCs. In due course, adherence to the code is probably going to become a requirement of FX membership. In Australia's case, that is certainly the case. So adherence to the code will be a requirement of membership of the Australian FX Committee probably around about by the end of this year. If we have adherence to the code being a requirement for FXC membership around the world, that very much embeds the code at the core of the FXC market. So if you look at the extent of coverage or membership of the various foreign exchange committees around the world, you're talking about a very, very high share of overall turnover in the foreign exchange market, whichever way you want to cut it, be it on the buy side, on the sell side, in terms of platforms, non-bank participants and the like. But it's also important that it extends beyond that and that there is, at the very least, an awareness of it across all market participants. Another dimension of adherence is that the BIS central banks have signalled their commitment by announcing that they themselves will follow the code and they expect their counterparties will do so too. In the case of the RBA, we ourselves will sign the statement of commitment and we will require that of our counterparties, that they too, if they want to be counterparties for us, sign the statement of commitment. Given that we've only just put out the full text of the code in the last month or so, there will be a period of time for market participants to adjust their practices where necessary to be in line with the principles in the code. I would not expect much time should be required to do this. This period of time might potentially be as short as 6 months, but no more than 12 months for the vast majority of market participants. How much effort this might require will in part depending on the nature and the extent of your engagement with the FX market. So in drafting the code, we've always kept the principle of proportionality at front of mind, which is how much of the code is directly relevant to you really depends on the nature of your engagement with the market. Another aspect which is relevant for Australia is that while I said this doesn't reflect regulation, ASIC has put out a statement, as a number of you may have seen, the day after the code was released, so May the 26th, which says that they will be using the code as a major point of guidance in terms of their surveillance of the FX market. So, as I said, the code itself is not regulation, but ASIC and the FCA has also put out a similar statement in the UK. Those two regulators, at least, will be using the code as a major part of a major guide to the sort of expectations they will be requiring of market participants in their surveillance of the FX market. Finally, it is vital that the code remains up to date and evolves as the market evolves, and so the code will be collectively owned, maintained and updated by the Global Foreign Exchange Committee, which met for the first time in London in May, and this will continue the public sector-private sector partnership which has supported the development of the code. So the Global FXC has membership from all the FXCs around the world, or 16 of them or so, and has both a public and a private sector representative from each of those. And it's chaired now by Chris Salmon of the Bank of England, and David Poof has graciously stayed on to act as deputy chair for the next 12 months. So the GFXC will regularly assess whether new information or market developments warrant updates or additions being made to the code. And as the first example of this, of doing this, given the diversity of views on the use of last look in the market, which we received over the feedback process, the GFXC is currently requesting feedback on trading in the last look window. So if you go to the GFXC website, there's a request for feedback on trading in the last look window, and it will tell you how you go about providing that feedback. And that will run through until mid-September. On a less frequent basis, the GFXC will oversee a more comprehensive review of the code, but that's probably going to be only every 3 or 4 years, probably every 3 years or so. So the code will continue to evolve with the market as necessary, and every number of years we'll have a more wholesale review. So to conclude, the global code is the culmination of 2 years of work by a group of people from both the private and the public sectors. The work reflected a very constructive and cooperative effort between the central banks and the market participants. And we all undertook this work in addition to our regular responsibilities at all hours of the day and night. I know that it was particularly true of Hugh and Matt and me in this time zone, that while the chair was from Australia, it didn't seem that that had much influence as to when the calls actually happened. And so the three of us had a lot of time in the middle of the night working on this thing. This contribution of time and effort reflected the fact that all of us on this group recognised the need to restore the public's faith in the foreign exchange market. We all share the view that the global code plays an important role in assisting that process and also in helping improve market functioning and overall confidence in the market. So let me finish there and get the rest of the panel up on stage. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Guy DeBell. I'm now pleased to introduce you to the remaining members of our esteemed panel. Joining Guy on stage, please make welcome Mr. Hugh Killen, the Global Head of FX for Westpac. Hugh is a member of the Australian FX Committee, a board member of the Global FX Division, and a member of the Market Participants Group, supporting the BIS Foreign Exchange Working Group on strengthening the Code of Conduct Standards and Principles in Foreign Exchange Markets. Welcome, Hugh. Please also welcome Mr. Chris Knight, the Distribution and Business Development at XTX Markets. Chris is an experienced financial markets practitioner with over 25 years of foreign exchange trading experience. While he is very comfortable in the technology arena, Chris maintains the key to success is practicing honesty and transparency in all his dealings. He is a member of the Global ACI FX Committee and also the Australian FX Committee. Welcome, Chris. Please also welcome Mr. Stuart Simmons, the Senior Portfolio Manager for FX from QIC. Stuart is also an experienced FX professional with over 17 years involvement in the industry, predominantly on the buy side. He is also a member of the Australian FX Committee. Welcome, Stuart. I'd now like to introduce our moderator for this panel, Mr. Colin Lambert, Managing Editor of P&L Magazine. Colin joined P&L Services in August 2001 after a 24-year career in the financial markets, predominantly in foreign exchange. His career took him to New York, Singapore, Toronto, Tokyo, and London, working for the buy-side and sell-side institutions in several roles, including as chief dealer. So with that, I will now hand over to Colin, who's going to roam from the floor. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, Kushala. If anybody does have any questions, we're going to have a session at the end for the media to ask questions of Guy about the code specifically. But if anyone's got any questions, we have two roving mics. So please just put your hand up and grab our attention and just jump in any time you like. And after being applauded, you blokes better be good. No. You've got your applause in early. What I'd like to really look into is like maybe look around the themes of, dig deeper into the themes of responsibility, prevention, coverage, and maybe the outcomes we're looking for from the code. Hugh, I thought I'd start with you. As an individual, plenty of individuals in this room may be fairly new to the Global Code. Obviously, we're aware it's been taking place, mm-hmm. but the details only recently become available. What sort of responsibilities should individuals be looking to take on now?
Colin, it's a good question. I might start at a little bit of a higher level, though, rather, before I just go into the individuals. I think most of the people in this room will be working for larger organisations which will have policies, procedures and compliance frameworks in place already. And the code will be supplementing that and probably sitting on top of them. So as an individual, it's really down to all of us to understand what those codes are and what's required of you in terms of where you operate and how you operate in the market. And at the end of the day, the FX market is something we should be really proud of, and we should actually, as part of that, understand how we operate as individuals with it. So make sure you're in an environment where if there's rules and policies that you understand, that you've read them, if you're unclear of something, that you actually go and seek out education and understand what's required of you, because you do have requirements on your individuals. Make sure when you see stuff that you don't understand that you escalate it, you put your hands up. One of the things that we talked about for a long time and implemented in Westpac was what we call a hands-up culture. So make sure we foster an openness so that when we're unsure or we don't know, we don't simply sit on stuff, but we actually start to talk about and surface issues so that we can get things sorted out. So really, at the end of the day, it's everyone's responsibility, is what I'd say. There isn't anywhere to hide from this by saying, look, I didn't know, or no one told me. It absolutely is true of people in this room that are leaders, that run businesses. There is a higher burden upon you to make sure the people that work for you understand what is required of them. But at the same time, if you guys that are working in teams, you know, there's a requirement on you guys as well. So be inquisitive would be the other thing that I'd say. And Guy spoke about this in his speech. We spent a lot of time on writing the code, for instance, in plain English. So I'd actually read it. It's pretty straightforward. It's written in plain English. We purposely kept the lawyers away from it so that we could actually read it and be understood. It's relatively short. And it has those examples at the back. And one of the areas we spent a huge amount of time was to get those examples right. So understand the framework that you operate in. If you don't understand something, put your hand up. If you see something that's a little bit amiss or doesn't seem right to you, escalate that through to your compliance departments or to your manager and start the dialogue.
Chris, from your point of view then, as a service provider, and obviously you interact with the platforms and the intermediaries that Guy mentioned quite a lot. What sort of responsibilities are these firms and are your firm taking on that maybe weren't there before?
Yeah, I think, the whole Code 55 principles touches, you know, it touches right across the board of everything there from ethics, integrity, fairness, transparency. So as a liquidity provider or a platform provider, that can be disclosures, treating your clients fairly, can have to do with markup, appropriate markup, taking off your clients. Mostly, if it's talking about a platform, for instance, an example would be fair access for everybody. Could be, fair routing, published rules of who's going to win a deal and where it will land. I think in the old days there was examples of people pay more bro, one deals and one ties. All sorts of different deals were done. You know, we've read some of them in some of the fines that have been handed out recently where different firms were given best bid offer and could match that and win a deal, for instance. So All this is about treating clients fairly, and it's also from the client's perspective. You know, I'd encourage everybody to read those disclosure documents, try and work out how people are treating your flow and your information, and making sure that's fair. Comparing it to others as well on the street.
So, Stuart, you've got, for example, maybe 25 service providers. They've all got disclosure documents, 25 pages long. Are you looking forward to your bedtime reading? I mean, on a more serious note, this actually creates some sort of extra work for the traditional buy-side client, doesn't it, under the code?
Well, under the code, the sell side have an obligation to provide terms and conditions of their relationship with the buy side. They do that under these disclosure documents. And really, if you dig deeper into the disclosure documents, it goes into the issues that are addressed in the code. Things like order handling, dealing with conflicts of interest, markup, last look, electronic trading, dealing with stop losses, all of those things are addressed in the code as well. And it's important that the sell side, or you recognise that the sell side aren't trying to circumvent the principles within the code, and they certainly can't circumvent the obligations under the regulators as well. So, you know, we'll take a look at those disclosure documents, but also keep in mind that, you know, they'll probably just try to explain some of the framework that's already in the code as well. And you know, you mentioned the responsibilities under the code, and I think it's fair to say that it's not just the sell side that this applies for, because you know, there's also been buy-side institutions that have been fined for behaviours that are inconsistent with what's in the code, particularly around separation of agency and principal dealing. So, you know, the buy side also has an obligation to step up as well and make sure that they fall under the code and adhere to the principles within it.
Because it strikes me, Guy, one of the things is very much, it's like a democratisation of responsibility post-code. Yeah, before there was a lot of emphasis on the sell side, as Stuart just said, but if I look at Principle 9, for instance, which says about you should be evaluating your service providers and platforms should be ensuring that, you know, their customers are adhering to the highest standards, have you democratised it sufficiently to actually give everyone responsibility?
Yeah, I think there is responsibility across the market. The other point I would think I'd note, in picking up a bit on what Stuart said, is that in the past, I think it wasn't agreed what the common... There wasn't a consensus as to what constituted good practice. So, whereas now what we've tried to provide is a basis for that consensus. So it gives me more chance to call out behaviour which I don't think is consistent, because actually there's some more commonality of understanding as what does constitute good practice. So to Hugh's point, it does allow me to ask that question and say, this doesn't look right to me, can you explain it? It may well be a perfectly decent explanation, but it allows me to call it out. The other thing I'd say, and again, coming from the buy side perspective, is that in the past, I could have seen something which I didn't think looked right, but there wasn't much I could do about it, because if I went down the road, someone else is probably going to do the same thing which didn't look right to me. Whereas what I would hope going forward is actually, if something doesn't look right, even if I can just say, I am going to take my business elsewhere, and actually that's a credible threat, because wherever else I take my business, I have confidence that they will be doing something which will involve treating me fairly in a way that may not have been true in the past.
Yeah, can I add to that, Guy? I had the... it was a lot of hard work and a lot of late nights, but in many ways, the privilege to sit on the market petitioners group as we were drafting the code. And the first meeting we had 2 years ago in London, you know, it was like the first date, we're all in the room together, it was banks and the sell side and the buy side was there as well. And it was actually really heartening how quickly we got to a position where both sides were very happy to negotiate and get to a point on forming up the code very quickly, and it was very collegiate. And what we found very quickly was we weren't a million miles from each other in terms of what we required from each other. The buy side really wanted to know on what basis they were dealing with the banks, and the sell side, I should say. And the sell side really wanted to be transparent and make it easy and clear for the buy side in terms of how they were going to act. And it was from that first meeting that framework came into place really, really quickly. And I think, you know, as this carries through in the code and the market more widely, hopefully we can keep that piece alive. And Guy spoke about, you know, the thing about peer pressure. And Colin, you talked about democratisation of the code. I think it's more around accountability, though. And it's a shared accountability across the market to understand it. And so, you know, an organisation like Westpac, for instance, has signed its statement of commitment already. And the reason we've done that is we've been on this journey for a couple of years, and we believe we must be in a position to do that now. We want to be a leader in this and lead the dialogue and make sure we can bring others along with us so we end up with a better market overall.
Stuart, does this create sort of some sort of big data issues that didn't exist before for clients? Because every time I talk to people about how you're going to evaluate service providers, they come back to the data. So does this create a data issue for you? And what I'd also like to dig into a little bit more is what happens to the guys that aren't as big as QIC, that are less sophisticated? How do we sort of help these people evaluate their service providers?
I think, you know, from that perspective, it's important to really streamline your dealing and your information processes to make sure you've got the ability to evaluate the trades and evaluate the impact those trades have had, how they've been handled with the counterparty. Within QIC, we've got that in place. We evaluate every trade on a trade-by-trade basis. We provide feedback to the counterparties and those who quoted but missed out, provide feedback on a quarterly, six-monthly and annual basis, more formally, in aggregation, how counterparties have done by trading centre, by currency, by method of execution. So, you know, the ability is there to be able to do that. I'd just say that it's not really necessary to try to buy in that ability. It's just a matter of becoming more efficient and having a look at your methods of execution. If you can't streamline enough to be able to do that, I would say focus your evaluation on the more sensitive trades, the larger trades, the trades which may have greater scope for exploitation, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And if really you get down the track where you're unable to do that, then try to execute in ways that leave yourself less vulnerable to that sort of exploitation. But, you know, most important, I think there is, under the code, an obligation to evaluate, to regularly evaluate the trades and how that's been handled by the counterparties. So people should try to adhere to that. In terms of smaller counterparties, I would say that, firstly, they should just really, you know, it's important to read the code. As Guy mentioned, it's like a handbook for how you should expect your orders to be handled, how you expect to be treated and conduct within the industry. And generally, you know, I really hope this opens up some sort of mature conversations between the buy side and the sell side, because for so long there's been this evasiveness about awkward conversations when it comes to things like order handling, markup and things like that. So hopefully, you know, Hugh mentioned the collegial nature between the buy side and the sell side in terms of drafting the document. Hopefully this leads to more of that collegial nature and just understanding that this is an industry where the principles are now laid out more fully in the code, and we can have conversations around some of the more touchy issues where previously that just hasn't been taken well.
I just had a couple of things on that, Colin, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
One, to pick up on the last point Stuart made, is if you look at the composition of the foreign exchange committees now, they've evolved considerably from where they were a decade ago,
Yeah. Where
they were pretty much close to all sell side. So now, you know, the membership of those is much more diverse across the full spectrum of the market than it was, which allows those sort of conversations to take place. And secondly, I think if I'm a smaller participant, I wouldn't say I outsource it to the larger participants, but I think the discipline the way I envisage it, at least, is that a fair chunk of the dissonance comes from the core of the market, from the larger participants. And yes, that does mean that you've got to be careful that that doesn't just mean that the discipline is only provided to those larger participants, but it is provided more universally. But it comes back to the sort of proportionality point I made when I was talking earlier, is that it is, you know, if you only have a sporadic engagement with the market, you do have a much less capacity to be able to assess the means by which your transaction was handled. But as Stuart said, and as I said earlier, this does give you a bit of a guide as to the sort of questions you should be able to ask. But I do think that a fair chunk of the discipline comes from that core of the market, which is fairly large, and just ensuring that it spreads out from there to the periphery.
Is that the big challenge that remains for the code then? Because it strikes me that what we've seen over the last 15 years is actually the number of participants that are quite active in foreign exchange market has broadened incredibly. Thanks mainly to the smaller prop shops in the US and then the rest of the world. How do we reach, is the challenge remaining to the GFXC now to actually reach those smaller firms that, you know, could easily be, can, you know, transact in 1,000, 2,000 trades a day?
Yeah, but in the end, all of those firms have a counterparty. And so I think that's part of the way that the code reaches out, is that a fair chunk of the, you think about liquidity providers, a fair chunk of that ends up in the hands of a fairly small number of market participants at the core of the market. And so all of those counterparties, either directly or not too many, doesn't take too many steps before they hit someone who's very much at the core of the market. And so this is where I think it comes in terms of the responsibility in terms of your counterparties as well. So it goes in both ways. And that's the way I think some of it reaches out to the sort of participants you're talking about. And I think, at least in the very near term, I'm fairly confident that we've, you know, got a pretty decent coverage at the core of the market. All of the people, pretty much all of the people on David's market participants group, have committed their, individually at least, their institutions will sign up to the code. That gets you a very large chunk of the market straight up. And I guess, from there, it reaches out to those other participants you're talking about.
And I guess also that's where maybe the platform providers and intermediaries have a role to play as well?
Yeah, at the very least in terms of information dissemination. And, you know, one big platform, I'm not sure what you would call them, a platform, whatever, but CLS. Yeah. Advantage that we've got the CEO of CLS, it was the chair of the market participants group, but that gets to a fair chunk of the market as well. So, plus our host tonight as well as Bloomberg. So there's, you know, a fairly large chunk of the core infrastructure are very much signed up.
Chris, is the answer to some of these problems at a smaller firm's technology?
Yeah, it can be, but I think, you know, the smaller firms are just going to naturally benefit from the bigger firms questioning and keeping their liquidity providers accountable.
I could think of a few that wouldn't like that sort of inspection.
Yeah, well, you know, I think at least as a smaller firm, you know, I always say, I price check if I'm buying a new fridge, so I don't know why somebody that, you know, buys $1 million once a month doesn't shop around or check how he's operating and make sure it's fair, you know, fair treatment. But no one I know, you know, in the big liquidity providers are going to treat different customers at different levels of, you know, ethical levels at least anyway. So the smaller guys will benefit from that. They should read their disclosure documents from their banks. Do they need to understand it all? Maybe they should just focus on the aspects that they think make a difference to them and poll their, you know, they can set up a survey and ask their liquidity providers, how do you treat me? What's your last look response time? How do you, you know, solve conflict resolution or whatever it's going to be?
Stu, does this also end up with a greater adoption of algos for execution?
It depends on how well this is adopted across the industry, because if there is more transparency and there's a higher level of trust, then maybe not. Maybe algos aren't the answer to everything. If people still feel like, you know, they're not getting the satisfaction, then it's probably going to push people down the route of algos where they see a fixed cost, you know, almost like a commission, rather than a cost which where there is no transparency. If you do get to the stage where you're able to have those grown-up conversations around markup and things like that. That's, you know, that will help to, I guess, maintain current practices in the industry. But, you know, algos aren't necessarily always the answer to every trade.
I mean, in the end, it's just what is best X, right? And it's not obvious to me that it's always and everywhere algo. Well, it's not always and everywhere you executing with an algo. It may well be you. And then it partly comes to one of the issues which we spent a lot of time on 12 months ago, which is around principal and agent. So what is the nature of your... If I'm using someone else's in an agency relationship, they can then be using an algo, but I don't need to have the full understanding of that algo. I still need to have some capacity, picking up on something Stuart said earlier, to be able to assess best X. That's still necessary, but that doesn't mean I myself need to be the operator of the algo. Mm.
The risk is there that flow could end up on an anonymous ECN trading against somebody that hasn't signed the code.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
So you do need to understand where your trade's going.
But then, Hugh, one of the easy ways for you as a service provider, as a bank, to turn around one of your clients who maybe is complaining about an execution is a TCO report. And a TCO report is probably easier to come up with an algo, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I don't... I'm going to echo Guy. I mean, people might call me cynical because I'm a bank, and I know we don't want everything to go down
with
the electronic route. But I don't think just everything being electronic solves the problem, and I think that's your point. You know, as a larger provider, we've got clients who interact with us algorithmically, and we supply TCA to them, and it's very transparent, and that's a service that works for them. We've got others that want an advisory approach, that want to take a full suite of products from us that's expensive for us to supply. And at no point does the code say that no one's, you know, that this is a commercial relationship. And so it depends, right? So I can show a very transparent process around TCA to a client that wants to see that and how we've charged them and how we've supplied the service. At the same time, we have really robust conversations with our clients now in the way that we are charging for our services, where the costs lie, and, you know, things around markup, for instance, which are discussions that quite simply didn't happen before, are happening now. And, yeah, they are a little bit awkward, but they're direct and they're to the point. And I think the more we have them, the better off we are as an industry.
Guy, are you comfortable that we're in a position whereby people are willing to make tough decisions and have those tough conversations, even though it may be commercially damaging to them and their business?
So I don't completely buy the second part, which is commercially damaging.
No.
I mean, I could turn it around and actually say some of that stuff I could regard as a competitive advantage rather than a competitive disadvantage. And it comes to another... another point, which is, I mean, in the end, it's an interesting commercial proposition where if I've taken advantage of my client for a number of years, but then turn around and pay a $1 billion fine a few years later, it's not clear to me that the cost benefit on that actually works.
No.
So there's that.
I guess I'm talking more in terms of an intermediary who actually may have witnessed what they consider bad behaviour at their number one client.
Yeah.
Have we overcome that? Can we overcome that challenge?
Yeah, I think so, because in the end, I think the reputational consequences may well end up on you.
Okay.
Particularly if I think about, you know, in the prime broking space, I think that's fairly self-evident. The other thing I would say is that, and it's reflected over the last few years, I think the market's already evolved to a point where a lot of, you know, practices have already changed a fair bit. As Hugh said, a lot of these sort of provide that a lot of these difficult conversations have already been had or are being had.
Mm.
And so the market, I think, has evolved somewhere to a better place. The other thing I'd note, which is the way I would regard what we've got in here as actually improving market functioning. So you often hear the line regulations worsening market functioning, whether or not that's true, put that aside. But in this case, I think what we've done is a conscious effort where the stuff we've got in here potentially improves market functioning. The stuff we've got around information sharing moves the market to a better place than where it was 2 or 3 years ago, I think, and has done actually over the past 12 months because we put that stuff out 12 months ago. So this is a case where actually, from a commercial point of view, it's not clear to me that it's actually... I could make a pretty strong case actually it's beneficial rather than a cost.
Okay. Hugh, we've got the 6 to 12 month window that Guy mentioned in terms of being ready to sign a statement of commitment and adhere to the code. What sort of processes are we looking at to put in place? Because one thing I get from, and with all due respect to any Americans in the room, one thing I get from my American colleagues is, well, yeah, what happens if you sign the code and then someone does something bad? Are you going to be facing another fine and more legal action? What sort of process have we got to get in place to make sure we can adequately monitor our institutions and our individuals' activity?
Yeah, it's a good question, Colin, and I think it comes back to this which is central to the code, which is around proportionality. And if you're one of the large players, whether you're on the buy side or the sell side, you will have very robust policies and procedures and compliance frameworks in place today. If you don't have those in place today, I'd be very surprised. And so, as we said, the code doesn't supplant that. In fact, the code sits on top of that, and it's a guideline in terms of how we operate. And so I would suggest that the larger players, if they can't already commit, are very close to getting to a point where they can do that, because they're going through their own policies and procedures, which should be at a much lower or a much tighter level than the code itself. So that's the first thing, I think, for the larger players. I think for the smaller players, it's about the proportionality piece, and it's about understanding each one of the principles and how they apply to them. And there'll be certain parts of the code that they may or not be involved in. So it's around making sure that you've got the right documentation, I think, internally, you're having the right conversations, and that at the end of the day, that you know, if you're small enough, you can actually use the code, I think, would be one of the things to be thinking through. But it'll be different for all players. I don't think the code in and of itself is a regulatory issue for an organisation. I think it's more around, hey, what's the right way from an ethics and an execution and a, you know, operational perspective to be a good counterparty in the market.
Stu, do you feel ready to... I'm not going to ask you, do you feel ready to sign, but do you feel actually comfortable with your sort of oversight and monitoring procedures?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think from the conversations I've had, the industry is already pretty well advanced on this. It's very consistent with what Hugh said and what Guy said previously. And practices have evolved a long way. I would say that, you know, within QRC, the code's been disseminated across the organisation. Management from all the areas are looking through to just ensure that each of their responsibilities, each of their... the aspects, you know, the code's divided in those six different areas. Operations has a look at it, risk and compliance has a look at it. But I would say that without needing to do too much, we're going to be ready to sign the code. Some things that do need to be put in place are just making sure that there is monitoring of that adherence to the code, similar to what Hugh was mentioning. But also another important aspect is, once the counterparty starts signing on, is to get an idea of what that reporting framework is for escalation of any issues. That's one of the principles of the code as well. And if the buy side gets an idea of or reaches out to the counterparties and says, you know, I'd like to know what your reporting framework is. If we have any issues, I'd like to know where those confidential channels are where we can report any issues. And that's going to put the fear into the FX salesperson for sure. So I'd encourage all the buy side to do that. But we've also got to be prepared to have those reporting channels ourselves, because we're a market participant. So alongside gathering reporting channels, we're going to need to be prepared too and hand those out.
Stuart, I think that's a really constructive piece that you're mentioning there. And I mentioned this in the beginning, Colin, when you asked me about how do we all individually adopt it, you know, it really is that escalation piece. What do I do if I see something? What do I do if I don't understand? That's just as important if I see something. And, you know, every organisation, the large organisations at least, will have those confidential channels in place today. So I actually really welcome that question when it comes from a client, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're easy little simple things that we can be thinking through today.
Chris, do you think, you know, obviously you talk to a lot of people in the industry as part of your daily work, you work on the ACI, you sit in the ACI FXC, do you get the impression that the industry is actually advancing, as everyone's discussed there, at the same pace?
I don't think it's advanced at the same pace, but it's advanced, clearly. Right. You know, I think when you look at the disclosure documents, different liquidity providers have a different, you know, there's from we'll do whatever we like to, you know, to we're going to treat you extremely fairly, symmetrical, last look, no last look or whatever. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done there. But, you know, as I read your article today that Guy mentioned, and you were talking about a race to the top, you know, this code is a baseline. So, you know, I think through competition, people will improve upon it and look to have that as a competitive advantage for them. You know, so last look, shorter windows, or full disclosure on what markup is. Or it could be in anything, free TCA tools, you know, analysis on all their flow. Could go in many directions, and I expect we're going to see that over the next few months when people start signing it up.
Stu, we've mentioned a lot here about rebuilding trust. Do you think that the global code document is going to be a key element in rebuilding that trust? Can it actually do that, help do that?
Absolutely, because it lays out the framework of what's accepted in the industry, and that really, you know, we all know what ethical behaviour is, but now you can see from the way that Hugh approaches this, you know, the banks are taking this very seriously. That plus $10 billion of fines tends to wake people up to what's acceptable. You know, you just need to look at some of the behaviours that have been called out in the past. And, you know, the banks can't afford that type of reputational damage anymore. So as long as, and I'm sure that message is filtering down to the frontline staff, and as long as that awareness grows on the buyer side as well, and throughout the platforms and all the other market participants, you know, I'm sure it's going to go a long way to helping that. And I think important, you know, what's also an important element to that building of trust is that people from the buyer side shouldn't be afraid to call out behaviour that they feel is, you know, against or not adhering to the principles of the code.
Well, I think, frankly, Hugh, anybody should be willing to call anybody out if they see that. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's fair. Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you think Chris, we'll end up with a bifurcated market whereby you'll get pools of liquidity for adherence and pools of liquidity for non-adherence? That sounds very sinister.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've thought about this with the anonymous ECNs as a good place to start, you know, because you can get four people with a, you know, a $10,000 server working out of a garage that can be a high-frequency liquidity provider these days, that, you know, wouldn't hurt, and I don't know what my firm's policy on this is yet, but I suspect it will be that we will ask the ECN, I don't want to have any anonymous counterparties that haven't signed up to the code. You know, that doesn't have to be prescriptive from the global code, that can just be us telling them that. So, yeah, I think you're going to get that. I think you're going to get pools of liquidity pools of liquidity that are firm. No last look. You're going to get more pools of liquidity with a lot shorter time window, for instance. And then it's up to the client to choose who they want to deal with.
Yeah, maybe I've got more faith in people, but I kind of fundamentally disagree with some of that. I think at the end of the day, this is about all of us owning the outcome here. And if all of a sudden people are chasing down another avenue to try and bifurcate or get around these rules that have been put in place, I think we've kind of lost the argument before we've begun. And so it's all of us that own that outcome. And if any of us are, you know, involved in making, you know, helping that happen, I can't see anyone to be willing to take that risk. And as a, you know, as a bank, the larger banks that sit in this room, I can't see that they'd want to be enabling that either. So, you know, I think, you know, understand the code, read the code, understand the regulation that comes from it. ASIC have been very clear that the principles of the code is a guideline for us all to use. Anyone that operates here under an AFSL here in Australia will have much more stringent guidelines than the code does itself. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I might be completely wrong and Chris is right, but I'd like to think that we've done enough work over the last 2.5 years to get to a point where we're much more sure on what's right and what's wrong. And, you know, definitely in my business at least, you know, we've seen the code as a really good tool for people to understand how do I have a proper conversation with the client, how do I actually enter the market when I'm operating on an order. You know, we've been willing participants in this. And I think at the end of the day, it's a really, really healthy thing for the business, for the market, I should say.
You know, I spoke at the FX Week conference here. And six people in the audience, sorry about that, six people in the audience said they would deal with a firm that hasn't signed the global code.
Yeah,
and I'll poll question. So, you know, I said that was irresponsible to their shareholders or
yeah, so you and I are a million miles away from each other on this, and I think it's up to us as liquidity providers to make sure that they don't get access to that liquidity.
But you mentioned anonymous, and two words keep on popping in my head, EFX Capital. So, you know, again, it's a peripheral player on a peripheral platform, but they got away with abuse using Last Look for years, hidden revenue sharing. There's still a challenge there to actually make sure that all of these firms, because, you know, frankly, Hugh, you're absolutely right. The banks in this room and the sell side will adhere to the highest possible standards. Unfortunately, are you not also held to the same standards as the lowest common denominator?
I'd like to think not. I mean, we hold ourselves up to the highest possible standards, and as should everyone in this room, buy side, sell side, doesn't matter really where you sit in that. And as individuals, you should be holding yourself up to the highest possible standards as well. And I think that goes to the very first question you asked, Colin. And, you know, like anything, you know, if you go out to get around the rules, well, then you might find a way through that. But that's not what this is about. And, you know, that's why I feel quite strongly about this. We spent a lot of time on this as an industry, you know, globally, to make sure we get this piece right. And that's why we brought the whole, you know, the whole market in, and emerging markets are involved. And, you know, I think the intent, at least, is really strong to make sure we have a very uniform approach to this.
So, Guy, with the code now available in its full form, in your eyes, what would be a good measure of success in a year or two's time if we're looking at it again?
So, I very much think would be that a large chunk of the market has signed the statement of commitment that's sitting there on a public registry or registries, which is available for everyone to see. Everyone to see. So, you know.
Yep.
I'm sitting there as a journalist, and I can say, okay, I can find out who all the people have signed up to this code. So first of all, I think that demonstration effect that a very large chunk of the market has signed up to the statement of commitment, and that's publicly visible. I think another measure of success partly comes back to what Stuart and Hugh have been talking about in terms of escalation, is that people are comfortable to escalate issues that they see, and that there are channels for them to do that as well. I mean, because I don't think we should kid ourselves and say, you know, bad stuff's never going to happen again. Yeah. We've suddenly got rid of bad behaviour. I mean, that's fanciful. But if and when that does occur, and that it gets called out. And so actually, to some extent, a measure of success actually would be that such behaviour is called out. Mm. And it's called out by the other point I'd make on that is it's called out by the industry rather than called out by an investigation 10 years down the track. So that I think would be a measure of success, is that this is a voluntary code, and to some extent there's a degree of self-regulation associated with that. And if there's clear evidence that the industry is capable and able to self-regulate, I think that would be a very much an indication of success.
Does anybody in the audience have any questions for the panel? No? Does any member of the media have any questions for Guy on the code?
Yeah, behind you.
Sorry. Around. Okay.
Hi there. Leo Shanahan from Sky News Business. I'm just interested, news overnight in London that a couple of traders are being extradited to New York from London. HSBC is once again the target of another Forex manipulation investigation. Australian regulators just not very good at finding bad behaviour, or are our bankers better behaved?
So I don't think that's a particularly... I think there's a couple of thick points worth making. Those offences occurred 10 years ago. So I think it's interesting that... You know, and I think the point we've been highlighting today is that the industry has moved to a better place. There are still legacy issues which are being dealt with through the courts and whatever, and we probably haven't seen the end of that. And coming to Colin's previous question, there are still those legacy issues to deal with. I think it's a question of whether the industry has moved and is in the process of moving to a better place, and I think there's a reasonable chance that has occurred, and yes, those legacy issues are still going to keep on giving for a while yet. And this is very much the work we did here is very much a response to those issues, and as they were surfaced, particularly going back sort of 5 years ago now, and particularly 2 or 3 years ago, which was the genesis for this work, was the very self-evident need to move the market to a place, and that's what this is about achieving, is moving the market to a better place. And yes, those issues will keep on surfacing every once in a while, but this is very much about the future and moving the market to a better place for the future and not about the past.
Last call for any questions? No, well, I'm aware we're keeping you from a very important drink. Hopefully all that noise outside was not people drinking our beer. The drinks are just outside. Please join me in thanking our panellists. Yeah.